Welcome to the second Stories of Healing episode. This episode is sponsored by my dear friends, Yosef and Julia Friedenberg in Los Angeles. This episode is about David. David is a 38-year-old client of mine, and as I've described in the past, this is not a real client, but it is a real client, meaning to say that I've taken bits and pieces of different people's stories, and I've woven them into one story in a way that I hope can be helpful and serve as a paradigm for people to self-reflect on themselves. So while this is not anyone's particular story and is not revealing of any particular person, it is a real story in the sense that what I'm painting here is a true profile of the type of dynamic and phenomenon that I've encountered in a number of different people, and is a struggle that I think is relevant and real for many people in different ways. David is 38 years old. He's married and he has 4 children. David initially came to therapy not so much on his own accord, not because of so much self-motivation, but really because his wife had been urging him to show up to go to therapy for quite some time. And things had really escalated in their relationship in terms of the difficulty, and she was really at her end. And he finally agreed to come. So when he came, he described to me begrudgingly what his wife was upset about. He told me with a lot of cynicism that his wife's chief complaint was that she described him as gaslighting her. Gaslighting has become a popular term. If anyone has not heard of it or is not familiar, let me just describe a little bit of what gaslighting means. Gaslighting is a term that's used to describe when somebody is invalidating of someone else's emotions or thoughts or comments or expressions. But not only are they invalidating, they do it in a way that actually leaves the other person questioning themselves or feeling like maybe they are crazy or maybe they're wrong. So it's not just telling someone that they disagree with them, but it's actually much more kind of sometimes even manipulative, but certainly more skillful, almost not necessarily intentionally to be evil or to be bad, but it almost undermines the person's expression in the first place. Because if you tell me X and I say, well, I disagree with X, so then you can still think X and you just know that I disagree with it. But if you tell me X and I start responding in ways that make you unsure if you even know what you think or why you think what you think or anything of that nature, I haven't even given the space for you to think what you think and I disagree with you. So gaslighting could take the form of denying certain events that took place. Gaslighting could take the form of responding actually with humor or just dismissiveness. Gaslighting can take the form of reversing the blame. It can take the form of responding to a point that isn't really the point, and so you're kind of diverting and confusing the person. It could be responding in simultaneously conflicting ways, again, creating that confusion or that doubt. Or it can take the form of shifting the accusation onto the other person. Gaslighting can take form in a number of different ways, as I just described, but also in other ways. It's not limited to any particular thing. There isn't a clear-cut definition. It's more of a term that describes a general way of responding to somebody's expression of emotion or feeling or thought or opinion, and responding in a way that, again, leaves them wondering why they even thought that in the first place. This is not the situation that David was describing, but, for example, if somebody is accused of, engaging in a behavior that is problematic or inappropriate in a relationship, and they respond to that by saying, how could you ever think that I would possibly do that? Right? So that would be a form of gaslighting in the sense that they haven't actually responded to the critique. They've questioned why the person would even feel that way. They haven't acknowledged that their spouse is feeling unsafe or mistrusting, and is now raising a complaint, and instead they're just responding in a way that actually turns the accusation back the other way. You're doing something wrong for even suspecting or feeling what you're feeling. There's something wrong with you doing that. You're not that. You're the one who's doing something wrong now. So that would be just an example of gaslighting. So David's wife describes him, as he's telling me, that she's upset that he gaslights her often. Again, he's saying this in a way of really being in denial of this and not liking that she says this, but telling me that this is what she says. He also says that she complains of him working too much, too often, and also getting angry. Not necessarily too often, but too intensely. That when he gets angry, it goes from 0 to 60 very quickly, and that it's very volatile. It gets very intense, very harsh. And that then he doesn't really engage in any productive conversation about whatever it is that he's angry about or whatever is going on. It's kind of a denial and a distance of whatever is going on, and then getting very angry very quickly, and then just pretending it never happened. That's how David describes, not necessarily as articulately, but that's how David describes why his wife wants him to be in therapy. After talking to him for quite a bit, that's what I'm able to kind of gather. He describes about himself that he has really good friends. He has a lot of fun with his group of friends. These have been his friends for a long time. He has a really good group of friends. He also describes being very efficient, very successful at work. He does very well managing people. And one of the things that he says in this context about why he's so frustrated by his wife's complaints is because he's never heard this. He never experiences any of these things from anyone else besides his wife. So he's great managing people at work. He has all these employees. Everyone seems to like him. Everyone seems to do well with him. He has this really good group of friends. He has popularity in the community that he's in. He does well in all these contexts. Interestingly, he does mention, kind of in passing when I ask him about it, that he does have some siblings that he gets along with fine, but he's not close with any of his siblings. So that's kind of an interesting point on the side. I mentioned to David that sometimes it's very helpful for me to be able to meet with the spouse of the client I'm working with, just so I can get some perspective and some of what's going on. Although I also mentioned that if he's not comfortable with that, another possibility that would be helpful would be if he could go home and ask for some concrete examples of what she considers to be the gaslighting and how she's experiencing that. And if he could kind of write it down, he doesn't have to agree with it at all. But if he could just come back in the next session giving me a very specific kind of relaying of what she's saying in her own words, again, even with the full permission for him to disagree, but to be able to give me that information. So he actually opted for that instead of having her come in. So he came back the next session and he read off the page again in a very dismissive way, but he read off the page telling me that what she said is as follows, as examples of gaslighting in their relationship that she experiences from him. She said that if she says to him, "I get scared to bring up certain topics with you because I feel that you respond very quickly and very harshly to me. And so I can't bring up certain topics, but I sometimes feel like I need to be able to bring up these topics." And according to her, he will respond by saying, "No one else ever thinks that." And that's his response when she brings up this issue that for years she's tried to figure out a way to work on this, and she expresses this to him, and he responds by simply saying, "No one else ever thinks that." The second example that he gave from her is if she says something like, "I need more help at home with the kids," he responds, again according to her, he responds saying, "When I do it myself, when I'm the one at home by myself, everything goes fine. I never have any of the issues that you have." That's a second example. A third is that she says to him after a big blow up or him getting very angry about something, she says, "You got so mad at me so quickly and you never apologized, or you just pretended it never happened." And he responds, according to her, by denying the story of what happened and telling over the story or relaying the sequence of events with missing and leaving out very significant details and significant parts of the story. So this is what he tells me that she is so deeply frustrated about and is really escalating the tension in their relationship. Seeing how bothered he is by all of this and how deeply he disagrees with this portrayal of things, I don't feel that it makes the most sense for me to try and just go straight into this. And instead, it makes more sense for me to try and build some connection and some trust and relationship with him. And to do that, at least in the beginning, by just asking him about himself and his life, his history, his family of origin. And so let me describe to you some of the things that he tells me in talking about his childhood, his history of origin, his family of origin, and this course of his life. The most significant thing I found in when I asked him about his childhood and whether there was anything interesting, anything difficult, anything less than ideal, anything better than ideal, anything noteworthy, he describes to me a really excellent and uniquely positive childhood, and describes a family that was wonderful. He was the oldest of four children in his family, a household that was intact. He describes a happy marriage between his parents. He describes his mother as having had a really good job and working really hard. His father as being a very spiritually connected person, a person who learned a lot, someone he respected a lot and really looked up to always. And all of this he describes very, very positively. He had good friends and enjoyed his childhood. When I ask him about, was there anything else, anything in addition to that, you know, was all of that sound so wonderful? Were there any challenges? And he responds by saying nothing really significant. There really wasn't anything, nothing that he can think of. And that just kind of ends there. Again, I don't feel that it's the right time to push further on that. And so instead, again, we kind of go back to just a kind of connecting, chatting, talking about his week type of session for a few weeks, you know, week in and week out, kind of talking on a more surface level about things going on in his life, whether it's at home, it's work, etc. Over time, though, I start noticing a pattern, because I notice him describing, as he's getting a little more comfortable, describing things that are happening in his life, things that are happening to him, and he seems to have some level of being bothered, things that are rubbing him the wrong way, things that he's not happy about, but he won't really express being upset or being sad or being hurt or being affected in any distressed or difficult way. He kind of just brushes it over, mentions it, but keeps going and kind of just reorients or reframes it very, very quickly in a fast-moving kind of a way, and really doesn't show being affected by it. So, for example, what I mean by that is he'll come in one week and describe that he found out something about one of his siblings, a difficult time they went through. I believe it was maybe that they lost their job or something of that nature. I think that they lost their job. And he describes finding out that everyone else in his family had already known this for a few months and no one had told him. And he had even had times that he saw family members and apparently everybody else already knew, but he didn't know. And he describes this with a lot of visibly uncomfortable feelings, but simply tells me about it and says that he doesn't really care, and he makes like a joke about it. He really kind of turns it into something humorous. And he's actually, by the way, he's very funny. So the use of humor is very charming and very effective to redirect what's going on. And so he says this to me visibly uncomfortable, but without acknowledging any discomfort, and really just kind of turning it into something funny. Another example I noticed over time was how often he would talk in a way that he was upset about the fact that his wife had a really close relationship with one of her sisters and would share very personal and private things with her sister, and that her sister was her go-to. And he described this in a way of clearly being upset about it, that he wanted to be his wife's go-to, and he didn't want her sister to be her go-to, and he wanted to be in the know. But he would always talk about this in a way of just kind of going back again and again to say, but I'm so happy that she has her sister. And without ever acknowledging that he actually is upset or feeling left out or feeling second or wanting more connection, he'd never acknowledge that. He'll just talk about it in a way that clearly he is upset, but without ever acknowledging that. Quickly, a third example would be that his wife had ordered new dining room chairs and he didn't like the color. But again, he just kind of talks about this without ever acknowledging that he's actually upset about it. He just talks about how, well, if I ever would have said anything, she would never listen to what I say, and he, you know, but it's fine. I really don't care. It's not a big deal. I really don't care. It doesn't bother me. And so I'm noticing this pattern of, if you see the commonality, the common thread in these examples. Now, it's not quite as obvious because he's not saying these things back to back, and he's not acknowledging them or talking about them in the framework that I'm presenting it now. But sprinkled in these very small ways throughout the just mundane chit-chat of the week-to-week sessions, I'm starting to pick up on seeing that. And to me, what's significant about that is that what I'm noticing in those three examples is that he is essentially doing to himself what his wife is complaining about him doing to her. I want to just repeat that to emphasize it. He's doing to himself what his wife is complaining about him doing to her. He came in because he described his wife as being very upset that when she brings something up, he either makes light of it, turns it back on her, or makes a joke to move on and divert, or he changes the story. Essentially, he doesn't give any significance to her feeling to give it any real space. And what I'm noticing in his experience with himself is that that's exactly what he's doing to himself. The reason he's doing it to his wife is because that's what he does to himself. When he feels hurt that he's left out of the family communication of things that actually matter and things that are vulnerable, he doesn't give himself his feeling any significance. He makes a joke about it. When he feels hurt that his wife goes to his sister before himself, goes to her sister before himself, he just redirects that very quickly by saying, no, but I'm happy that she has her sister. When he notices being left out of the decision-making process for these new chairs, he just tells himself, but it's not a big deal. It's not something I should care about. And so if he's doing this to his wife because he's doing it to himself, then what that leads me to think is that he's also, the reason he's doing it to himself is because this is what was done to him. Meaning, if we trace it back, we know he's doing it to his wife because he's doing it to himself. But why would he be doing it to himself? Because this is what he was trained to do. This was born somewhere. This came from somewhere. And as always, as we've spoken about, there is a certain level of predisposition and nature. And there's also a significant impact of nurture, of the environment, of experiences, of the ways that caregivers relate to us and the experiences we have in life. And so now that I've gotten curious about this trail, about this possibility, I want to go back to the family history and get a little more information. Because if you remember, his description of this family and his life experience was just all positive. And nothing really significant was his line and his response to when I asked about anything challenging. And now what I'm wondering is, well, maybe that makes sense because his whole way of being is to just tell himself that everything's fine and everything's good. And so, of course, when he looks at his childhood, let's say he did have a negative experience, he did have a distressing or challenging experience, he would have told himself it's no big deal. So, of course, then he doesn't have anything to describe because he's already undermined and invalidated the significance of anything being significant. So, of course, his response is going to be, well, no, nothing really significant. And by the way, what I'm starting to think is this would also explain the possibility that he has these outbursts of anger. Because if a person is always undermining what they're feeling, at some point, somehow, somewhere, there's going to be a moment that it bursts. And then it looks to outsiders like it's from 0 to 60. But really, it's because everything was underneath the surface that whole time. There's so much resentment and so much distress that's building and building and building. And eventually, it just pops. And then after it pops, since, again, the person doesn't really have the mindset or the understanding of validating their experience, being in their feelings. So then after that explosion, they're just going to pretend it never happened because that's how they deal with these kinds of things. So I'm going back now with him, not necessarily explaining all of this, but just staying in a place of curiosity and connecting relationally and taking it slow. And I go back to ask him more about his childhood, and this time I ask more pinpointed questions. So instead of the general question of, you know, anything challenging or anything noteworthy, I start asking more pinpointed questions. And what I start to find out, first of all, what's interesting is that he had told me that he never lacked for anything and things were always great and his mother had a good job. But then he does describe to me that he actually grew up in an affluent community with a financial situation that was a very under the average of what was around him, at least as far as he could tell. And that it always seemed that money was a stressor and that they couldn't do the things that his friends were doing. His friends would go on big vacations. They couldn't go on big vacations. They had big bar mitzvahs. He didn't have a big bar mitzvah. They would go to camp, sleepaway camp for the whole summer, and he would only be able to go for half the summer, etc. So that was interesting because, again, when he first described it to me, it was everything was perfect. But then what catches my attention even more is that he then, in passing, as if it's nothing, tells me that when he was 8 years old, his younger sister, who is 2 years younger than him, had gotten very sick. Thank God she ended up and is healthy and was fine. But there was a year where she was very sick and spent a lot of time in the hospital. And I notice as he's telling me this, because even though he's telling it to me without a lot of detail and as if it's not a big deal, I do notice that he's taking a big breath, a deep breath, the type of breath where there's distress. And so you can see that there's something there, even if he can't really acknowledge it. But you can see that there's something there. So I ask more about this, and I ask about what that experience was like, and were his parents at the hospital a lot, or, you know, who took care of him when all this was going on. And he describes that his parents were out of the house a lot. There were many nights that they would sleep there. There were a number of different scares and really difficult times. And they had a babysitter that took care of him a lot and ended up even sleeping over a lot. I asked him if he remembers his parents ever saying anything to him during this process, and he tells me that he remembers them telling him how proud they were of him for being so strong. So I didn't do this kind of intervention that I want to describe to you. I didn't do this right away. But what I want to describe now to the best of my ability is what we did at the next moment that I thought was appropriate to do this. I asked him if he could picture his 8-year-old self during this time, and see what came up. And he noticed himself, he pictured himself as an 8-year-old at home with his parents at the hospital. And he's sitting on the floor playing with some toy. And I asked him to look at this boy, this 8-year-old boy that he's picturing, and then to see if he could notice anything going on for this boy, what his body language communicates. And he said that it looked like the boy was a little bit sad, just kind of down a little bit, but that there was also a look of worry or some kind of faint hint of fear or being scared that you could see in the boy's eyes. So I asked him to introduce his adult self to this young 8-year-old, if he could imagine himself going over to him and saying, "Hi, I am," kind of a funny thing, I'm you in the future or in the now. I'm the adult you. And to tell the boy that you're here because you know he's going through a hard time and you wanted to see if you can help him in any way. And if the boy reacts in a way that he doesn't want you there or anything negative, we want to respect that. But if he seems okay with it, then let's engage a little bit. And so I asked David to ask his 8-year-old self, "What are you feeling right now?" And the 8-year-old describes that he's feeling scared. "What are you feeling scared about?" And so he says he's scared about his sister, how she's doing. But then he says, but really I'm even more scared because whenever I see my parents, they don't look okay. And I'm worried about them, and I'm worried about what might happen to them with all of this. And that's really what scares me. And then as we notice this, as we sit with this for a moment, I ask David to acknowledge that that's okay to feel scared, that it makes sense to feel scared, that is scary. It's scary to have a sister who's sick, and it's scary to have parents who look like they're not doing so okay, because we want to feel that our parents are the strongest, safest people in the world. They keep us feeling safe. And if they don't look like they're doing okay, then that can be really scary for us. And I see that David is not taking this in. He's not wanting to. There's something coming up. He had started with his eyes closed, and now he's opened his eyes. And the more I'm talking, I notice something's. So I ask him, like, what do you notice right now? He says, this isn't working for me. So I ask him why, and he says, because if I allow him to feel scared, he's going to feel too scared. I don't want him to feel so scared. And I hear that. So I respond by saying, I get that. That makes sense to me. And we can understand why there would be that concern. Kind of ironic, right? Because we're scared to be scared. And so I acknowledge that's okay. And if you notice the meta levels here of the same kind of parallel things taking place between the 8-year-old and the adult and the adult and the therapist, right? The validity to feeling scared for the 8-year-old, or the validity to the adult feeling scared about feeling scared. And just making space for that, making sense of that. It makes sense for the 8-year-old to feel scared, and it makes sense for the adult to feel scared of being scared. And I try to name that for him. But then I also kind of pop out of the kind of intense, immersive, emotional experience, and I go to a more intellectual space for a second to try and explain to David speaking to the adult in the room, the adult part of self, that it makes sense that we might be concerned that if we feel a feeling, we're going to get lost in the feeling. And so naturally, what some people might do is to just deny or bypass the feeling altogether. And there are two extremes in how we respond to feelings. One extreme is to feel the feeling and get swallowed up by the feeling. The other extreme is to bypass the feeling altogether. And neither one of those is really what works in a healthy way. But there is a third option, which is in the middle, and that is to feel the feeling, acknowledge the feeling, make sense of the feeling, and then also find a way to make a choice of how to do what's best for us in this situation, which oftentimes will be to try and distract from the feeling or to try and move into something that's going to help us feel better. But first to acknowledge and make sense of the feeling, and then to figure out what we need to help ourselves with that feeling. I give David an example of how I was walking with one of my kids the other day, and we were down this street. We saw a dog approaching us, you know, on a leash with an owner, someone walking their dog, and my kid got very, very scared. And so I could have responded by allowing them to be scared, validating the fear, talking about the fear, wallowing in the fear, walking away from the dog because of the fear, and just being swallowed up by the fear. The other extreme would have been to just tell them there's nothing to be afraid about and kind of pull them, you know, pull their arm harder to walk in that direction or whatever it might be, or just tell them that only babies are afraid. Or anything like that, that would just be denying, invalidating, bypassing, overriding their feelings. Either one of those extremes is really not healthy. But instead, a third option would be to acknowledge that it can be scary, that it makes sense, that I understand that you're afraid. And do you see the leash that the dog is on that the owner is holding? And do you see right now that as they're getting closer to us, the owner is actually taking up more of the rope of the leash so that the dog has less, it can't go out as far? And do you see that this dog just passed by another kid and didn't do anything? And so there can be an acknowledgement of the fear, a validity of the fear, of the feeling, and then also providing whatever help is needed to move away from that feeling. And so I ask David if this makes sense to him, and he says it does make sense. And so then I invite him to come back in to the experience with his younger self. How would you apply that? Can you look at this 8-year-old and validate his being scared? To tell him that it makes sense that he's scared, that it's okay to feel scared. And to then think of what he might need to feel a little bit less scared. And the 8-year-old says, I need to know that my parents are going to be okay. And so I say, okay, can you imagine that? Can you allow the 8-year-old, can you use what we call a corrective experience using the power of imagination to imagine that you're 8 years old and you're feeling afraid, and your parents come home from the hospital and they see that you're afraid and they tell you that it's okay to be afraid. And then they also give you what you need, which is that whatever happens, we're going to be okay. We are going to still be your parents, and we are still going to take care of you. And we are going to take care of ourselves. And as they're talking to you, they look confident. and they mean what they're saying. There's a strength to what they're saying. There's something real to what they're saying. And I ask David to notice what the 8-year-old looks like in this moment, and he says that he can see that he looks a lot more relaxed and he looks very relieved. And I ask him to notice this and notice it in his body. And he does, and he notices it. And then something interesting happens. A moment later, he says, but now he looks sad. The 8-year-old looks sad. So I ask him, okay, so let's ask him again, what are you sad about? Before it was, what are you afraid of? But now it's, what are you sad about? And the boy says, well, I'm sad because tomorrow is my birthday. And I don't know what's going to be because my parents are so busy. But I feel like I'm not supposed to care because my sister's sick and it feels like it's like so selfish for me to care. And so I ask David, can you respond to him? How would you respond? What would you want him to know? What would you want to tell him? And David says he doesn't know, so I push him a little further and say, well, can you try and use the same method that we just used about fear? And so he, you know, kind of awkwardly agrees to try. And together we try to communicate to the 8-year-old that it's perfectly okay to be feeling sad. That tomorrow is your birthday and your parents are so busy with your sister. And it's not selfish, or at least not in any bad way. Maybe it's a good kind of selfish. It's whatever you want to call it. It's perfectly okay and it makes sense. And we need a hard pause on that, that it's okay and it makes sense and the feeling is real. And then we can also ask him, and what do you need? And this time the boy says he doesn't know. He just looks sad. So I ask David, what could you do for him? What could you think of? What would you imagine doing? And he says, well, I would throw him the biggest birthday party in the world. So I say, okay, so just again using imagination, the sky's the limit when we're using imagination, so go for it. And he imagines this and he pictures the 8-year-old being able to choose everything exactly how he wants it. And when we finish all of this, I ask him, say, you know, you told me before that your parents lying to you as a kid in this situation was that they're so proud of you for being so strong, which is a very nice thing for them to say. I'm curious if there's anything else you wish they would have said to you, or anything else you can think now would have been actually helpful for you. And together what we're able to figure out is, well, maybe he needed to hear that they're so proud of me for being so strong, but also that it's okay when I'm not feeling strong. That it's okay and it makes sense when I'm feeling really sad or scared or impatient in this process or lonely, and that we want to hear about it when you're feeling those things. So all of that is kind of the inner child work that we were able to do together, and more elaborately and over time and revisiting it. And of course, it's never quite perfect, and it never solves anything in totality, and everything is always unfinished, and there's always process and more. But if you can understand and see the connection here, the reason I thought this was so important is because what we traced was that David's wife feels that he doesn't give validity to what she's feeling. He reacts and responds in a gaslighting way, in a way that undermines or bypasses or overrides whatever it is that she's trying to express. And what we were able to identify is that he's really doing that to himself too. And then we were able to identify that, well, that originated because that's what was happening for him in an experience where he was feeling very strong feelings, but those feelings were never given real validity. They were never given space. And so he had to find ways to deal with those feelings by using humor, bypassing, overriding, underestimating their significance, etc. And so he started doing that from an early age to himself because that was what the environment around him was doing to him. And so then, whenever he feels something, he feels left out of family information. He feels left out of the decision of choosing the chair color. But he undermines or uses humor or bypasses his own feelings. And then when his wife expresses something that she's feeling, he does the same to her. And so the work for him going forward, based on all that, is to start noticing his feelings, his own feelings, and giving them significance, giving them validity, working with them, pausing to acknowledge them, seeing what they're really trying to tell him, understanding that feelings have a rhyme and a reason. They're not just an irrational part of us that we want to just get rid of or avoid. And my hope for him and anyone trying to engage this kind of process is that if he can do this, the three levels of relationship that we always talk about in this podcast can all be enhanced. His relationship with himself can be enhanced because he begins to have self-awareness and self-knowledge and know who he is and experience himself in a more multidimensional way. His relationship with others, with loved ones, in this case, his spouse, can be so greatly and deeply improved because he can actually then acknowledge and understand and hear her feeling as a feeling. Which doesn't mean that every time she has a criticism of him or a complaint that it's 100% accurate or that it's all his fault, but it means that he can hear what she's saying. He can take it in a way that he can take it seriously. He can give it space and validity and now have a conversation about it, even if he disagrees with it. But he can have a conversation about it. He doesn't have to bypass it or undermine it. And also, he'll be able to express his own feelings so they don't have to get bottled up and create underlying resentment that eventually just blows over and explodes. But instead, he can actually feel what he's feeling and express it in measured and balanced and appropriate ways. And lastly, I also hope for him and believe that this can actually deeply enhance and enrich his relationship with Hashem, with God, with spirituality. Because if we don't have access to our own feelings, then the depth of connection we can access with God is handicapped. It's limited. Because our ability to experience God is through, not only, not exclusively, but is in a major way, is through our feelings. And so if we don't really feel our feelings, they just happen under the radar and they're bypassed in one way or another, then we're missing that channel, that access point of a relationship with Hashem that's born through our pain, through our sadness, or through our worry, or through our fear, and similarly through our joy, through our relief, through the experience of connection. In the feelings of any of those feelings, we have access to an emotional relationship with Hashem. And so for any of us and all of us, if any of what I described here for David is something that you understand, that you can relate to, and similarly, if you feel that you experience what David's wife might be experiencing, hopefully this story can give you perspective and insight on what might be happening for your spouse. And so this is the sort of healing, as we've talked about, that it's not complete, it's not perfect, but the type of work that we can do within ourselves to try and strengthen some of the very underdeveloped muscles that we might have, or to try and redirect or correct some of the ways that we may have in our younger experiences, we may have adapted to difficult circumstance in a way that at that time made sense. And now there's an important update, an important evolution or development into a new stage that is ready to take place. And one of the ways that we might do that is through this sort of process, through our adult self who has a knowledge in the current reality, beginning to develop a relationship with a younger self that does not yet have that knowledge, but can come into contact with that update through this sort of inner dialogue, this inner relationship that we can have with ourself that also will ultimately enhance the relationship we have with other people and with God.